afternoon, I heard Peter go downstairs for the second time. I mustered the courage to walk through the silent house by myself and reached the warehouse. Bosch was on the packing table, playing with Peter, who was getting ready to put him on the scale and weigh him. "Hi, do you want to have a look?" Without any preliminaries, he picked up the cat, turned him over on his back, deftly held his head and paws, and began the lesson. "This is the male sexual organ. These are a few stray hairs. And that's his backside." The cat flipped himself over and stood up on his little white feet. If any other boy had pointed out the male sexual organ to me, I would never have given him a second glance. But Peter went on talking in a normal voice about what is otherwise a very awkward subject. Nor did he have any ulterior motives. By the time he'd finished, I felt so much at ease that I started acting normally too. We played with Bosch, had a good time, chatted a bit, and finally sauntered through the long warehouse to the door. "Were you there when Mushi was fixed?"
"Yeah, sure. It doesn't take long. They give the cat an anesthetic, of course."
"Do they take something out?"
"No. The vet just snips the tube. There's nothing to see on the outside."
I had to get up my nerve to ask a question, since it wasn't as normal as I thought. "Peter, the German word Geschlechtsteil means sexual organ, doesn't it? But then the male and female ones have different names."
"I know that."
"The female one is a vagina, that I know, but I don't know what it's called in males." "Oh well," I said. "How are we supposed to know these words? Most of the time you just come across them by accident."
"Why wait? I'll ask my parents. They know more than I do, and they've had more experience."
We were already on the stairs, so nothing more was said. Yes, it really did happen. I'd never have talked to a girl about this in such a normal tone of voice. I'm also certain that this isn't what Mother meant when she warned me about boys. All the same, I wasn't exactly my usual self for the rest of the day. When I thought back to our talk, it struck me as odd. But I've learned at least one thing. There are young people, even those of the opposite sex, who can discuss these things naturally without cracking jokes. Is Peter really going to ask his parents a lot of questions? Is he really the way he seemed yesterday? Oh, what do I know? Yours, Anne. Friday, January 28th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, in recent weeks I've developed a great liking for family trees and the genealogical tables of royal families. I've come to the conclusion that once you begin your search, you have to keep digging deeper and deeper into the past, which leads you to even more interesting discoveries. Although I'm extremely diligent when it comes to my schoolwork and can pretty much follow the BBC Home Service on the radio, I still spend many of my Sundays sorting out and looking over my movie star collection, which has grown to a very respectable size. Mr. Coogler makes me happy every Monday by bringing me a copy of Cinema and Theater magazine. The less worldly members of our household often refer to this small indulgence as a waste of money, yet they never fail to be surprised at how accurately I can list the actors in any given movie, even after a year. Bep, who often goes to the movies with her boyfriend on her day off, tells me on Saturday the name of the show they're going to see, and I then proceed to rattle off the names of the leading actors and actresses and the reviews. Mom's recently remarked that I wouldn't need to go to the movies later on because I know all the plots, the names of the stars, and the reviews by heart. Whenever I come sailing in with a new hairstyle, I can read the disapproval on their faces, and I can be sure someone will ask which movie star I'm trying to imitate. My reply that it's my own invention is greeted with skepticism. As for the hairdo, it doesn't hold its set for more than half an hour. By that time, I'm so sick and tired of their remarks that I race to the bathroom and restore my hair to its normal mass of curls. Yours, Anne. Friday, January 28th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, this morning I was wondering whether you ever felt like a cow having to chew my stale news over and over again until you're so fed up with the monotonous fare that you yawn and secretly wish Anne would dig up something new. Sorry, I know you find it dull as ditch water, but imagine how sick and tired I am of hearing the same old stuff. If the talk at mealtime isn't about politics or good food, then Mother or Mrs. Vandy trot out stories about their childhood that we've heard 1,000 times before. Or Dussel goes on and on about beautiful racehorses, his Charlotte's extensive wardrobe, leaky rowboats, boys who can swim at the age of 4, aching muscles and frightened patients. It all boils down to this.
Whenever one of the eight of us opens his mouth, the other seven can finish the story for him. We know the punchline of every joke before it gets told, so that whoever's telling it is left to laugh alone. The various milkmen, grocers, and butchers of the two former housewives have been praised to the skies or run into the ground so many times that in our imaginations, they've grown as old as Methuselah. There's absolutely no chance of anything new or fresh being brought up for discussion in the annex. Still, all this might be bearable if only the grown-ups weren't in the habit of repeating the stories we hear from Mr. Kleiman, Jan, or Meep, each time embellishing them with a few details of their own, so that I often have to pinch my arm under the table to keep myself from setting the enthusiastic storyteller on the right track. Little children, such as Anne, must never, ever correct their elders, no matter how many blunders they make or how often they let their imaginations run away with them. Jan and Mr. Kleiman love talking about people who have gone underground or into hiding. They know we're eager to hear about others in our situation, and that we truly sympathize with the sorrow of those who've been arrested as well as the joy of prisoners who've been freed. Going underground or into hiding has become as routine as the proverbial pipe and slippers that used to await the man of the house after a long day at work. There are many resistance groups, such as Free Netherlands, that forge identity cards, provide financial support to those in hiding, organize hiding places, and find work for young Christians who go underground. It's amazing how much these generous and unselfish people do, risking their own lives to help and save others. The best example of this is our own helpers, who have managed to pull us through so far and will hopefully bring us safely to shore, because otherwise they'll find themselves sharing the fate of those they're trying to protect. Never have they uttered a single word about the burden we must be. Never have they complained that we're too much trouble. They come upstairs every day and talk to the men about business and politics, to the women about food and wartime difficulties, and to the children about books and newspapers. They put on their most cheerful expressions, bring flowers and gifts for birthdays and holidays, and are always ready to do what they can. That's something we should never forget. While others display their heroism in battle or against the Germans, our helpers prove theirs every day by their good spirits and affection. The most bizarre stories are making the rounds, yet most of them are really true. For instance, Mr. Kleiman reported this week that a soccer match was held in the province of Helderland. One team consisted entirely of men who had gone underground, and the other of 11 military policemen. In Hilversum, new registration cards were issued. In order for the many people in hiding to get their rations, you have to show this card to obtain your ration book, or else pay 60 guilders a book. The registrar asked all those hiding in that district to pick up their cards at a specified hour, when the documents could be collected at a separate table. All the same, you have to be careful that stunts like these don't reach the ears of the Germans. Yours, Anne. Sunday, January 30th, 1944. My dearest Kit, another Sunday has rolled around. I don't mind them as much as I did in the beginning, but they're boring enough. I still haven't gone to the warehouse yet, but maybe sometime soon. Last night I went downstairs in the dark, all by myself, after having been there with Father a few nights before. I stood at the top of the stairs while German planes flew back and forth, and I knew I was on my own, that I couldn't count on others for support. My fear vanished. I looked up at the sky and trusted in God. I have an intense need to be alone. Father has noticed I'm not my usual self, but I can't tell him what's bothering me. All I want to do is scream, "Let me be! Leave me alone!" Who knows? Perhaps the day will come when I'm left alone more than I'd like. Anne Frank. Thursday, February 3rd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, invasion fever is mounting daily throughout the country. If you were here, I'm sure you'd be as impressed as I am at the many preparations, though you'd no doubt laugh at all the fuss we're making. Who knows? It may all be for nothing. The papers are full of invasion news and are driving everyone insane with such statements as, "In the event of a British landing in Holland, the Germans will do what they can to defend the country, even flooding it if necessary." They've published maps of Holland with the potential flood areas marked. Since large portions of Amsterdam were shaded in, our first question, was what we should do if the water in the streets rose to above our waists. This tricky question elicited a variety of responses. It'll be impossible to walk or ride a bike, so we'll have to wade through the water.
Don't be silly. We'll have to try and swim. We'll all put on our bathing suits and caps and swim underwater as much as we can, so nobody can see we're Jews.
Oh, baloney. I can just imagine the ladies swimming with the rats biting their legs. That was a man, of course. We'll see who screams loudest.
We won't even be able to leave the house. The warehouse is so unstable, it'll collapse if there's a flood.
Listen, everyone, all joking aside, we really ought to try and get a boat.
Why bother? I have a better idea. We can each take a packing crate from the attic and row with a wooden spoon.
I'm going to walk on stilts. I used to be a whiz at it when I was young.
Jan Geese won't need to. He'll let his wife ride piggyback, and then Meep will be on stilts.
So, now you have a rough idea of what's going on, don't you, Kit? This lighthearted banter is all very amusing, but reality will prove otherwise. The second question about the invasion was bound to arise. What should we do if the Germans evacuate Amsterdam?
Leave the city along with the others. Disguise ourselves as well as we can.
Whatever happens, don't go outside. The best thing to do is to stay put. The Germans are capable of herding the entire population of Holland into Germany, where they'll all die.
Of course we'll stay here. This is the safest place. We'll try to talk Kleiman and his family into coming here to live with us.
We'll somehow get hold of a bag of wood shavings so we can sleep on the floor. Let's ask Meep and Kleiman to bring some blankets just in case, and we'll order some extra cereal grains to supplement the 65 pounds we already have. Jan can try to find some more beans. At the moment, we've got about 65 pounds of beans and 10 pounds of split peas, and don't forget the 50 cans of vegetables.
What about the rest, Mother? Give us the latest figures.
10 cans of fish, 40 cans of milk, 20 pounds of powdered milk, 3 bottles of oil, 4 crocks of butter, 4 jars of meat, 2 big jars of strawberries, 2 jars of raspberries, 20 jars of tomatoes, 10 pounds of oatmeal, 9 pounds of rice. That's it. Our provisions are holding out fairly well. All the same, we have to feed the office staff, which means dipping into our stock every week. So it's not as much as it seems. We have enough coal and firewood, candles too.
Let's all make little money bags to hide in our clothes so we can take our money with us if we need to leave here.
We can make lists of what to take first in case we have to run for it and pack our knapsacks in advance.
When the time comes, we'll put 2 people on the lookout, one in the loft at the front of the house and one in the back.
Hey, what's the use of so much food if there isn't any water, gas, or electricity?
We'll have to cook on the wood stove, filter the water, and boil it.
We should clean some big jugs and fill them with water. We can also store water in the 3 kettles we use for canning and in the washtub.
Besides, we still have about 230 pounds of winter potatoes in the spice storeroom.
All day long, that's all I hear. Invasion, invasion, nothing but invasion. Arguments about going hungry, dying, bombs, fire extinguishers, sleeping bags, identity cards, poison gas, etc., etc. Not exactly cheerful. A good example of the explicit warnings of the male contingent is the following conversation with Jan. Annex.
We're afraid that when the Germans retreat, they'll take the entire population with them.
Jan.
That's impossible. They haven't got enough trains.
Annex.
Trains? Do you really think they'd put civilians on trains? Absolutely not. Everyone would have to hoof it.
Or, as Dussel always says, per pedes apostolorum.
Jan.
I can't believe that. You're always looking on the dark side. What reason would they have to round up all the civilians and take them along?
Annex. Don't you remember Goebbels saying that if the Germans have to go, they'll slam the doors to all the occupied territories behind them?
Jan. They've said a lot of things.
Annex.
Do you think the Germans are too noble or humane to do it? Their reasoning is, if we go under, we'll drag everyone else down with us.
Jan. You can say what you like, I just don't believe it.
Annex. It's always the same old story. No one wants to see the danger until it's staring them in the face.
Jan. But you don't know anything for sure, you're just making an assumption.
Annex.
Because we've already been through it all ourselves. First in Germany and then here. What do you think's happening in Russia?
Jan, you shouldn't include the Jews. I don't think anyone knows what's going on in Russia. The British and the Russians are probably exaggerating for propaganda purposes, just like the Germans.
Annex. Absolutely not. The BBC has always told the truth. And even if the news is slightly exaggerated, the facts are bad enough as they are. You can't deny that millions of peace-loving citizens in Poland and Russia have been murdered or gassed.
I'll spare you the rest of our conversations. I'm very calm and take no notice of all the fuss. I've reached the point where I hardly care whether I live or die. The world will keep on turning without me, and I can't do anything to change events anyway. I'll just let matters take their course and concentrate on studying and hope that everything will be all right in the end. Yours, Anne.
Tuesday, February 8th, 1944. Dear Kitty, I can't tell you how I feel. One minute I'm longing for peace and quiet, and the next for a little fun. We've forgotten how to laugh. I mean, laughing so hard you can't stop. This morning I had the giggles, you know, the kind we used to have at school. Margot and I were giggling like real teenagers. Last night there was another scene with Mother. Margot was tucking her wool blanket around her when suddenly she leapt out of bed and carefully examined the blanket. What do you think she found? A pin! Mother had patched the blanket and forgotten to take it out. Father shook his head meaningfully and made a comment about how careless Mother is. Soon afterward, Mother came in from the bathroom, and just to tease her, I said,
Du bist doch eine echte Rabenmutter.
Of course. She asked me why I'd said that, and we told her about the pin she'd overlooked. She immediately assumed her haughtiest expression and said, You're a fine one to talk. When you're sewing, the entire floor is covered with pins. And look, you've left the manicure set lying around again. You never put that away either. I said I hadn't used it, and Margot backed me up, since she was the guilty party. Mother went on talking about how messy I was until I got fed up and said rather curtly, I wasn't even the one who said you were careless. I'm always getting blamed for other people's mistakes. Mother fell silent, and less than a minute later I was obliged to kiss her goodnight. This incident may not have been very important, but these days everything gets on my nerves. As I seem to be going through a period of reflection at the moment, and letting my mind range over anything and everything, my thoughts have naturally turned to Father and Mother's marriage. It has always been presented to me as an ideal marriage. Never a quarrel, no angry faces, perfect harmony, etc., etc. I know a few things about Father's past, and what I don't know, I've made up. I have the impression that Father married Mother because he felt she would be a suitable wife. I have to admit I admire Mother for the way she assumed the role of his wife and has never, as far as I know, complained or been jealous. It can't be easy for a loving wife to know she'll never be first in her husband's affections, and Mother did know that. Father certainly admired Mother's attitude and thought she had an excellent character. Why marry anyone else? His ideals had been shattered and his youth was over. What kind of marriage has it turned out to be? No quarrels or differences of opinion, but hardly an ideal marriage. Father respects Mother and loves her, but not with the kind of love I envision for a marriage. Father accepts Mother as she is often annoyed, but says as little as possible because he knows the sacrifices Mother has had to make. Father doesn't always ask her opinion about the business, about other matters, about people, about all kinds of things. He doesn't tell her everything because he knows she's far too emotional, far too critical, and often far too biased. Father's not in love. He kisses her the way he kisses us. He never holds her up as an example because he can't. He looks at her teasingly or mockingly, but never lovingly. It may be that Mother's great sacrifice has made her harsh and disagreeable toward those around her, but it's guaranteed to take her even farther from the path of love, to arouse even less admiration, and one day, Father is bound to realize that while, on the outside, she has never demanded his total love, on the inside, she has slowly but surely been crumbling away. She loves him more than anyone, and it's hard to see this kind of love not being returned.
So should I actually feel more sympathy for Mother? Should I help her? And Father? I can't. I'm always imagining another mother. I just can't. How could I? She hasn't told me anything about herself, and I've never asked her to. What do we know of each other's thoughts? I can't talk to her. I can't look lovingly into those cold eyes. I can't. Not ever. If she even had one quality an understanding mother is supposed to have, gentleness or friendliness or patience or something, I'd keep trying to get closer to her. But as for loving this insensitive person, this mocking creature, it's becoming more and more impossible every day. Yours, Anne. Saturday, February 12th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, the sun is shining, the sky is deep blue, there's a magnificent breeze, and I'm longing, really longing, for everything. Conversation, freedom, friends, being alone. I long to cry. I feel as if I were about to explode. I know crying would help, but I can't cry. I'm restless. I walk from one room to another, breathe through the crack in the window frame, feel my heart beating as if to say, fulfill my longing at last. I think spring is inside me. I feel spring awakening. I feel it in my entire body and soul. I have to force myself to act normally. I'm in a state of utter confusion, don't know what to read, what to write, what to do. I only know that I'm longing for something. Yours, Anne. Monday, February 14th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, a lot has changed for me since Saturday. What's happened is this. I was longing for something, and still am, but a very small part of the problem has been resolved. On Sunday morning, I noticed, to my great joy, I'll be honest with you, that Peter kept looking at me, not in the usual way. I don't know, I can't explain it, but I suddenly had the feeling he wasn't as in love with Margot as I used to think. All day long, I tried not to look at him too much, because whenever I did, I caught him looking at me, and then, well, it made me feel wonderful inside, and that's not a feeling I should have too often. Sunday evening, everyone, except Pam and me, was clustered around the radio, listening to the immortal music of the German masters. Dussel kept twisting and turning the knobs, which annoyed Peter and the others, too. After restraining himself for half an hour, Peter asked somewhat irritably if he would stop fiddling with the radio. Dussel replied in his haughtiest tone, "Ich mach das schon." Peter got angry and made an insolent remark. Mr. Van Dan sided with him, and Dussel had to back down. That was it. The reason for the disagreement wasn't particularly interesting in and of itself, but Peter has apparently taken the matter very much to heart, because this morning, when I was rummaging around in the crate of books in the attic, Peter came up and began telling me what had happened. I didn't know anything about it, but Peter soon realized he'd found an attentive listener and started warming up to his subject. "Well, it's like this," he said. "I don't usually talk much, since I know beforehand I'll just be tongue-tied. I start stuttering and blushing, and I twist my words around so much I finally have to stop, because I can't find the right words. That's what happened yesterday. I meant to say something entirely different, but once I started, I got all mixed up. It's awful. I used to have a bad habit, and sometimes I wish I still did. Whenever I was mad at someone, I'd beat them up instead of arguing with them. I know this method won't get me anywhere, and that's why I admire you. You're never at a loss for words. You say exactly what you want to say and aren't in the least bit shy." "Oh, you're wrong about that," I replied. "Most of what I say comes out very differently from the way I'd planned. Plus, I talk too much and too long, and that's just as bad." "Maybe, but you have the advantage that no one can see you're embarrassed. You don't blush or go to pieces." I couldn't help being secretly amused at his words. However, since I wanted him to go on talking quietly about himself, I hid my laughter, sat down on a cushion on the floor, wrapped my arms around my knees, and gazed at him intently. I'm glad there's someone else in this house who flies into the same rages as I do. Peter seemed relieved that he could criticize Dussel without being afraid I'd tell. As for me,
I was pleased, too, because I sensed a strong feeling of fellowship, which I only remember having had with my girlfriends. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, February 15th, 1944. The minor run-in with Dussel had several repercussions, for which he had only himself to blame. Monday evening, Dussel came in to see Mother and told her triumphantly that Peter had asked him that morning if he'd slept well, and then added how sorry he was about what had happened Sunday evening. He hadn't really meant what he'd said. Dussel assured him he hadn't taken it to heart. So everything was right as rain again. Mother passed this story on to me, and I was secretly amazed that Peter, who'd been so angry at Dussel, had humbled himself, despite all his assurances to the contrary. I couldn't refrain from sounding Peter out on the subject, and he instantly replied that Dussel had been lying. You should have seen Peter's face. I wish I'd had a camera. Indignation, rage, indecision, agitation, and much more crossed his face in rapid succession. That evening, Mr. Van Dan and Peter really told Dussel off. But it couldn't have been all that bad, since Peter had another dental appointment today. Actually, they never wanted to speak to each other again. Wednesday, February 16th, 1944. Peter and I hadn't talked to each other all day, except for a few meaningless words. It was too cold to go up to the attic, and anyway, it was Margot's birthday. At 12:30, he came to look at the presents and hung around chatting longer than was strictly necessary, something he'd never have done otherwise. But I got my chance in the afternoon. Since I felt like spoiling Margot on her birthday, I went to get the coffee and after that the potatoes. When I came to Peter's room, he immediately took his papers off the stairs, and I asked if I should close the trapdoor to the attic. Sure, he said. Go ahead. When you're ready to come back down, just knock and I'll open it for you. I thanked him, went upstairs, and spent at least 10 minutes searching around in the barrel for the smallest potatoes. My back started aching, and the attic was cold. Naturally, I didn't bother to knock, but opened the trapdoor myself. But he obligingly got up and took the pan out of my hands. I did my best, but I couldn't find any smaller ones. Did you look in the big barrel? Yes, I've been through them all. By this time, I was at the bottom of the stairs, and he examined the pan of potatoes he was still holding. Oh, but these are fine, he said, and added as I took the pan from him. My compliments. As he said this, he gave me such a warm, tender look that I started glowing inside. I could tell he wanted to please me, but since he couldn't make a long complimentary speech, he said everything with his eyes. I understood him so well and was very grateful. It still makes me happy to think back to those words and that look. When I went downstairs, Mother said she needed more potatoes, this time for dinner, so I volunteered to go back up. When I entered Peter's room, I apologized for disturbing him again. As I was going up the stairs, he stood up, went over to stand between the stairs and the wall, grabbed my arm and tried to stop me. I'll go, he said. I have to go upstairs anyway. I replied that it wasn't really necessary, that I didn't have to get only the small ones this time. Convinced, he let go of my arm. On my way back, he opened the trap door and once again took the pan from me. Standing by the door, I asked, "What are you working on?" "French," he replied. I asked if I could take a look at his lessons. Then I went to wash my hands and sat down across from him on the divan. After I'd explained some French to him, we began to talk. He told me that after the war, he wanted to go to the Dutch East Indies and live on a rubber plantation. He talked about his life at home, the black market, and how he felt like a worthless bum. I told him he had a big inferiority complex. He talked about the war, saying that Russia and England were bound to go to war against each other and about the Jews. He said life would have been much easier if he'd been a Christian or could become one after the war. I asked if he wanted to be baptized, but that wasn't what he meant either. He said he'd never be able to feel like a Christian, but that after the war he'd make sure nobody would know he was Jewish. I felt a momentary pang. It's such a shame he still has a touch of dishonesty in him. Peter added, "The Jews have been and always will be the chosen people." I answered, "Just this once, I hope they'll be chosen for something good." But we went on chatting very pleasantly, about father, about judging human character, and all sorts of things,
so many that I can't even remember them all. I left at 5:15 because Bep had arrived. That evening, he said something else I thought was nice. We were talking about the picture of a movie star I'd once given him, which has been hanging in his room for at least 1.5 years. He liked it so much that I offered to give him a few more. "No," he replied, "I'd rather keep the one I've got. I look at it every day, and the people in it have become my friends." I now have a better understanding of why he always hugs Mushi so tightly. He obviously needs affection, too. I forgot to mention something else he was talking about. He said, "No, I'm not afraid, except when it comes to things about myself, but I'm working on that." Peter has a huge inferiority complex. For example, he always thinks he's so stupid and we're so smart. When I help him with French, he thanks me 1,000 times. One of these days I'm going to say, "Oh, cut it out, you're much better at English and geography." And Frank. Thursday, February 17th, 1944. Dear Kitty, I was upstairs this morning, since I promised Mrs. Vandy I'd read her some of my stories. I began with Ava's Dream, which she liked a lot, and then I read a few passages from The Secret Annex, which had her in stitches. Peter also listened for a while, just the last part, and asked if I'd come to his room sometime to read more. I decided I had to take a chance right then and there, so I got my notebook and let him read that bit where Katie and Hans talk about God. I can't really tell what kind of impression it made on him. He said something I don't quite remember, not about whether it was good, but about the idea behind it. I told him I just wanted him to see that I didn't write only amusing things. He nodded, and I left the room. We'll see if I hear anything more. Yours, Anne Frank. Friday, February 18th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, whenever I go upstairs, it's always so I can see him. Now that I have something to look forward to, my life here has improved greatly. At least the object of my friendship is always here, and I don't have to be afraid of rivals, except for Margot. Don't think I'm in love, because I'm not, but I do have the feeling that something beautiful is going to develop between Peter and me. A kind of friendship and a feeling of trust. I go see him whenever I get the chance, and it's not the way it used to be, when he didn't know what to make of me. On the contrary, he's still talking away as I'm heading out the door. Mother doesn't like me going upstairs. She always says I'm bothering Peter and that I should leave him alone. Honestly, can't she credit me with some intuition? She always looks at me so oddly when I go to Peter's room. When I come down again, she asks me where I've been. It's terrible, but I'm beginning to hate her. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, February 19th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, it's Saturday again, and that should tell you enough. This morning, all was quiet. I spent nearly an hour upstairs making meatballs, but I only spoke to him in passing. When everyone went upstairs at 2:30 to either read or take a nap, I went downstairs with blanket and all to sit at the desk and read or write. Before long, I couldn't take it anymore. I put my head in my arms and sobbed my heart out. The tears streamed down my cheeks, and I felt desperately unhappy. Oh, if only he had come to comfort me. It was 4:00 by the time I went upstairs again. At 5:00, I set off to get some potatoes, hoping once again that we'd meet. But while I was still in the bathroom fixing my hair, he went to see Bosch. I wanted to help Mrs. Vandy and went upstairs with my book and everything, but suddenly I felt the tears coming again. I raced downstairs to the bathroom, grabbing the hand mirror on the way. I sat there on the toilet, fully dressed, long after I was through, my tears leaving dark spots on the red of my apron, and I felt utterly dejected. Here's what was going through my mind. Oh, I'll never reach Peter this way. Who knows? Maybe he doesn't even like me, and he doesn't need anyone to confide in. Maybe he only thinks of me in a casual sort of way. I'll have to go back to being alone, without anyone to confide in, and without Peter, without hope, comfort, or anything to look forward to. Oh, if only I could rest my head on his shoulder and not feel so hopelessly alone and deserted. Who knows? Maybe he doesn't care for me at all, and looks at the others in the same tender way. Maybe I only imagined it was especially for me.
Oh, Peter, if only you could hear me or see me.
If the truth is disappointing, I won't be able to bear it.
A little later, I felt hopeful and full of expectation again, though my tears were still flowing on the inside. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Sunday, February 20th, 1944. What happens in other people's houses during the rest of the week happens here in the annex on Sundays. While other people put on their best clothes and go strolling in the sun, we scrub, sweep, and do the laundry. 8 o'clock. Though the rest of us prefer to sleep in, Dussel gets up at 8. He goes to the bathroom, then downstairs, then up again, and then to the bathroom, where he devotes a whole hour to washing himself. 9:30. The stoves are lit, the blackout screen is taken down, and Mr. Van Dan heads for the bathroom. One of my Sunday morning ordeals is having to lie in bed and look at Dussel's back when he's praying. I know it sounds strange, but a praying Dussel is a terrible sight to behold. It's not that he cries or gets sentimental, not at all, but he does spend a quarter of an hour, an entire 15 minutes, rocking from his toes to his heels. Back and forth, back and forth. It goes on forever, and if I don't shut my eyes tight, my head starts to spin. 10:15. The Van Dans whistle. The bathroom's free. In the Frank family quarters, the first sleepy faces are beginning to emerge from their pillows. Then everything happens fast, fast, fast. Margot and I take turns doing the laundry. Since it's quite cold downstairs, we put on pants and headscarves. Meanwhile, Father is busy in the bathroom. Either Margot or I have a turn in the bathroom at 11, and then we're all clean. 11:30. Breakfast. I won't dwell on this, since there's enough talk about food without my bringing the subject up as well. 12:15. We each go our separate ways. Father, clad in overalls, gets down on his hands and knees and brushes the rug so vigorously that the room is enveloped in a cloud of dust. Mr. Dussel makes the beds, all wrong, of course, always whistling the same Beethoven violin concerto as he goes about his work. Mother can be heard shuffling around the attic as she hangs up the washing. Mr. Van Dan puts on his hat and disappears into the lower regions, usually followed by Peter and Mushi. Mrs. Van D dons a long apron, a black wool jacket, and overshoes, winds a red wool scarf around her head, scoops up a bundle of dirty laundry, and, with a well-rehearsed washerwoman's nod, heads downstairs. Margot and I do the dishes and straighten up the room. Wednesday, February 23rd, 1944. My dearest Kitty, the weather's been wonderful since yesterday, and I've perked up quite a bit. My writing, the best thing I have, is coming along well. I go to the attic almost every morning to get the stale air out of my lungs. This morning, when I went there, Peter was busy cleaning up. He finished quickly and came over to where I was sitting on my favorite spot on the floor. The two of us looked out at the blue sky, the bare chestnut tree glistening with dew, the seagulls and other birds glinting with silver as they swooped through the air, and we were so moved and entranced that we couldn't speak. He stood with his head against a thick beam while I sat. We breathed in the air, looked outside, and both felt that the spell shouldn't be broken with words. We remained like this for a long while, and by the time he had to go to the loft to chop wood, I knew he was a good, decent boy. He climbed the ladder to the loft, and I followed. During the 15 minutes he was chopping wood, we didn't say a word either. I watched him from where I was standing and could see he was obviously doing his best to chop the right way and show off his strength. But I also looked out the open window, letting my eyes roam over a large part of Amsterdam, over the rooftops and onto the horizon, a strip of blue so pale it was almost invisible. As long as this exists, I thought, this sunshine and this cloudless sky, and as long as I can enjoy it, how can I be sad? The best remedy for those who are frightened, lonely, or unhappy is to go outside, somewhere they can be alone, alone with the sky, nature, and God. For then, and only then, can you feel that everything is as it should be, and that God wants people to be happy amid nature's beauty and simplicity. As long as this exists, and that should be forever, I know that there will be solace for every sorrow, whatever the circumstances. I firmly believe that nature can bring comfort to all who suffer. Oh, who knows, perhaps it won't be long before I can share this overwhelming feeling of happiness with someone who feels the same as I do. Yours, Anne. P.S. Thoughts. To Peter. We've been missing out on so much here, so very much, and for such a long time. I miss it just as much as you do. I'm not talking about external things, since we're well provided for in that sense. I mean the internal things. Like you, I long for freedom and fresh air, but I think we've been amply compensated for their loss. On the inside, I mean. This morning, when I was sitting in front of the window and taking a long, deep look outside at God and nature, I was happy. Just plain happy. Peter, as long as people feel that kind of happiness within themselves, the joy of nature, health, and much more besides, they'll always be able to recapture that happiness. Riches, prestige, everything can be lost. But the happiness in your own heart can only be dimmed. It will always be there, as long as you live, to make you happy again. Whenever you're feeling lonely or sad, try going to the loft on a beautiful day and looking outside. Not at the houses and the rooftops, but at the sky. As long as you can look fearlessly at the sky, you'll know that you're pure within and will find happiness once more. Sunday, February 27th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, from early in the morning to late at night, all I do is think about Peter. I fall asleep with his image before my eyes, dream about him, and wake up with him still looking at me. I have the strong feeling that Peter and I aren't really as different as we may seem on the surface, and I'll explain why. Neither Peter nor I have a mother. His is too superficial, likes to flirt, and doesn't concern herself much with what goes on in his head. Mine takes an active interest in my life, but has no tact, sensitivity, or motherly understanding. Both Peter and I are struggling with our innermost feelings. We're still unsure of ourselves and are too vulnerable, emotionally, to be dealt with so roughly. Whenever that happens, I want to run outside or hide my feelings. Instead, I bang the pots and pans, splash the water, and am generally noisy so that everyone wishes I were miles away. Peter's reaction is to shut himself up, say little, sit quietly and daydream, all the while carefully hiding his true self. But how and when will we finally reach each other? I don't know how much longer I can continue to keep this yearning under control. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, February 28th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, it's like a nightmare, one that goes on long after I'm awake. I see him nearly every hour of the day, and yet I can't be with him. I can't let the others notice, and I have to pretend to be cheerful, though my heart is aching. Peter Schiff and Peter Van Dan have melted into one Peter, who's good and kind, and whom I long for desperately. Mother's horrible. Father's nice, which makes him even more exasperating. And Margot's the worst, since she takes advantage of my smiling face to claim me for herself, when all I want is to be left alone. Peter didn't join me in the attic, but went up to the loft to do some carpentry work. At every rasp and bang, another chunk of my courage broke off, and I was even more unhappy. In the distance, a clock was tolling. Be pure in heart. Be pure in mind. I'm sentimental, I know. I'm despondent and foolish, I know that too. Oh, help me. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, March 1st, 1944. Dearest Kitty, my own affairs have been pushed to the background by a break-in. I'm boring you with all my break-ins, but what can I do when burglars take such pleasure in honoring geese and company with their presence? This incident is much more complicated than the last one, in July 1943. Last night at 7:30, Mr. Van Dan was heading, as usual, for Mr. Kugler's office, when he saw that both the glass door and the office door were open. He was surprised, but he went on through and was even more astonished to see that the alcove doors were open as well, and that there was a terrible mess in the front office. "There's been a burglary," flashed through his mind. But just to make sure, he went downstairs to the front door, checked the lock, and found everything closed. Bep and Peter must just have been very careless this evening,
Mr. Van D. concluded. He remained for a while in Mr. Kugler's office, switched off the lamp, and went upstairs without worrying much about the open doors or the messy office. Early this morning, Peter knocked at our door to tell us that the front door was wide open and that the projector and Mr. Kugler's new briefcase had disappeared from the closet. Peter was instructed to lock the door. Mr. Van Dan told us his discoveries of the night before, and we were extremely worried. The only explanation is that the burglar must have had a duplicate key, since there were no signs of a forced entry. He must have sneaked in early in the evening, shut the door behind him, hidden himself when he heard Mr. Van Dan, fled with the loot after Mr. Van Dan went upstairs, and, in his hurry, not bothered to shut the door. Who could have our key? Why didn't the burglar go to the warehouse? Was it one of our own warehouse employees, and will he turn us in, now that he's heard Mr. Van Dan, and maybe even seen him? It's really scary, since we don't know whether the burglar will take it into his head to try and get in again. Or was he so startled when he heard someone else in the building that he'll stay away? Yours, Anne. P.S. We'd be delighted if you could hunt up a good detective for us. Obviously, there's one condition. He must be relied upon not to inform on people in hiding. Thursday, March 2nd, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Margot and I were in the attic together today. I can't enjoy being there with her the way I imagine it'd be with Peter, or someone else. I know she feels the same about most things as I do. While doing the dishes, Bet began talking to Mother and Mrs. Van Dan about how discouraged she gets. What help did those two offer her? Our tactless mother, especially, only made things go from bad to worse. Do you know what her advice was? That she should think about all the other people in the world who are suffering. How can thinking about the misery of others help if you're miserable yourself? I said as much. Their response, of course, was that I should stay out of conversations of this sort. The grown-ups are such idiots. As if Peter, Margot, Bep, and I didn't all have the same feelings. The only thing that helps is a mother's love, or that of a very, very close friend. But these two mothers don't understand the first thing about us. Perhaps Mrs. Van Dan does, a bit more than Mother. Oh, I wish I could have said something to poor Bep, something that I know from my own experience would have helped. But Father came between us, pushing me roughly aside. They're all so stupid. I also talked to Margot about Father and Mother, about how nice it could be here if they weren't so aggravating. We'd be able to organize evenings in which everyone could take turns discussing a given subject. But we've already been through all that. It's impossible for me to talk here. Mr. Van Dan goes on the offensive. Mother gets sarcastic and can't say anything in a normal voice. Father doesn't feel like taking part, nor does Mr. Dussel. And Mrs. Van D is attacked so often that she just sits there with a red face, hardly able to put up a fight anymore. And what about us? We aren't allowed to have an opinion. My, my, aren't they progressive? Not have an opinion. People can tell you to shut up, but they can't keep you from having an opinion. You can't forbid someone to have an opinion, no matter how young they are. The only thing that would help Bep, Margot, Peter, and me would be great love and devotion, which we don't get here. And no one, especially not the idiotic sages around here, is capable of understanding us, since we're more sensitive and much more advanced in our thinking than any of them ever suspect. Love. What is love? I don't think you can really put it into words. Love is understanding someone, caring for him, sharing his joys and sorrows. This eventually includes physical love. You've shared something, given something away, and received something in return, whether or not you're married, whether or not you have a baby. Losing your virtue doesn't matter, as long as you know that for as long as you live, you'll have someone at your side who understands you, and who doesn't have to be shared with anyone else. Yours, Anne M. Frank. At the moment, Mother's grouching at me again. She's clearly jealous because I talk to Mrs. Van Dan more than to her. What do I care? I managed to get hold of Peter this afternoon, and we talked for at least 45 minutes. He wanted to tell me something about himself, but didn't find it easy. He finally got it out, though it took a long time. I honestly didn't know whether it was better for me to stay or to go, but I wanted so much to help him. I told him about Bep and how tactless our mothers are. He told me that his parents fight constantly about politics and cigarettes and all kinds of things. As I've told you before, Peter's very shy, but not too shy to admit that he'd be perfectly happy not to see his parents for a year or two. "My father isn't as nice as he looks," he said, "but in the matter of the cigarettes, Mother's absolutely right." I also told him about my mother, but he came to Father's defense. He thought he was a terrific guy. Tonight, when I was hanging up my apron after doing the dishes, he called me over and asked me not to say anything downstairs about his parents having had another argument and not being on speaking terms. I promised, though I'd already told Margot, but I'm sure Margot won't pass it on. "Oh, no, Peter," I said. "You don't have to worry about me. I've learned not to blab everything I hear. I never repeat what you tell me." He was glad to hear that. I also told him what terrible gossips we are, and said, "Margot's quite right, of course, when she says I'm not being honest. Because, as much as I want to stop gossiping, there's nothing I like better than discussing Mr. Dussel." "It's good that you admit it," he said. He blushed, and his sincere compliment almost embarrassed me, too. Then we talked about upstairs and downstairs some more. Peter was really rather surprised to hear that we don't like his parents. "Peter," I said, "you know I'm always honest, so why shouldn't I tell you this as well? We can see their faults, too." I added, "Peter, I'd really like to help you. Will you let me? You're caught in an awkward position, and I know, even though you don't say anything, that it upsets you." "Oh, your help is always welcome." "Maybe it'd be better for you to talk to Father. You can tell him anything. He won't pass it on." "I know, he's a real pal." "You like him a lot, don't you?" Peter nodded, and I continued. "Well, he likes you too, you know." He looked up quickly and blushed. It was really touching to see how happy these few words made him. "You think so?" he asked. "Yes," I said. "You can tell from the little things he lets slip now and then." Then Mr. Van Dan came in to do some dictating. "Peter's a terrific guy, just like Father. Yours, Anne M. Frank." Friday, March 3rd, 1944. My dearest Kitty, when I looked into the candle tonight, I felt calm and happy again. It seems Grandma is in that candle, and it's Grandma who watches over and protects me and makes me feel happy again. But there's someone else who governs all my moods, and that's Peter. I went to get the potatoes today, and while I was standing on the stairway with my pan full, he asked, "What did you do during the lunch break?" I sat down on the stairs and we began to talk. The potatoes didn't make it to the kitchen until 5:15, an hour after I'd gone to get them. Peter didn't say anything more about his parents. We just talked about books and about the past. Oh, he gazes at me with such warmth in his eyes. I don't think it will take much for me to fall in love with him. He brought the subject up this evening. I went to his room after peeling potatoes and remarked on how hot it was. "You can tell the temperature by looking at Margot and me, because we turn white when it's cold and red when it's hot," I said. "In love?" he asked. "Why should I be in love?" It was a pretty silly answer, or rather, question. "Why not?" he said, and then it was time for dinner. What did he mean? Today I finally managed to ask him whether my chatter bothered him. All he said was, "Oh, it's fine with me." I can't tell how much of his reply was due to shyness. "Kitty, I sound like someone who's in love and can talk about nothing but her dearest darling. And Peter is a darling. Will I ever be able to tell him that? Only if he thinks the same of me. But I'm the kind of person you have to treat with kid gloves. I know that all too well. And he likes to be left alone, so I don't know how much he likes me. In any case, we're getting to know each other a little better. I wish we dared to say more. But who knows, maybe that time will come sooner than I think." Once or twice a day he gives me a knowing glance. I wink back, and we're both happy. It seems crazy to talk about his being happy, and yet I have the overwhelming feeling he thinks the same way I do. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, March 4th, 1944. Dear Kitty, this is the first Saturday in months that hasn't been tiresome, dreary, and boring. The reason is Peter. This morning, as I was on my way to the attic to hang up my apron, Father asked whether I wanted to stay and practice my French, and I said yes. We spoke French together for a while, and I explained something to Peter, and then we worked on our English. Father read aloud from Dickens, and I was in seventh heaven since I was sitting on Father's chair close to Peter. I went downstairs at 11:15. When I went back up at 11:30, Peter was already waiting for me on the stairs. We talked until 12:45. Whenever I leave the room, for example after a meal, and Peter has a chance and no one else can hear, he says, "Bye, Anne. See you later." Oh, I'm so happy. I wonder if he's going to fall in love with me after all. In any case, he's a nice boy, and you have no idea how good it is to talk to him. Mrs. Van D. thinks it's all right for me to talk to Peter, but today she asked me teasingly, "Can I trust you two up there?" "Of course," I protested. "I take that as an insult." Morning, noon, and night, I look forward to seeing Peter. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. Before I forget, last night everything was blanketed in snow. Now it's thawed, and there's almost nothing left. Monday, March 6th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, ever since Peter told me about his parents, I felt a certain sense of responsibility toward him. Don't you think that's strange? It's as though their quarrels were just as much my business as his, and yet I don't dare bring it up anymore, because I'm afraid it makes him uncomfortable. I wouldn't want to intrude, not for all the money in the world. I can tell by Peter's face that he ponders things just as deeply as I do. Last night I was annoyed when Mrs. Van D. scoffed, "The thinker!" Peter flushed and looked embarrassed, and I nearly blew my top. Why don't these people keep their mouths shut? You can't imagine what it's like to have to stand on the sidelines and see how lonely he is, without being able to do anything. I can imagine, as if I were in his place, how despondent he must sometimes feel at the quarrels, and about love. Poor Peter, he needs to be loved so much. It sounded so cold when he said he didn't need any friends. Oh, he's so wrong. I don't think he means it. He clings to his masculinity, his solitude, and his feigned indifference so he can maintain his role, so he'll never, ever have to show his feelings. Poor Peter, how long can he keep it up? Won't he explode from this superhuman effort? Oh, Peter, if only I could help you, if only you would let me. Together we could banish our loneliness, yours and mine. I've been doing a great deal of thinking, but not saying much. I'm happy when I see him, and happier still if the sun shines when we're together. I washed my hair yesterday, and because I knew he was next door, I was very rambunctious. I couldn't help it. The more quiet and serious I am on the inside, the noisier I get on the outside. Who will be the first to discover the chink in my armor? It's just as well that the Van Dans don't have a daughter. My conquest could never be so challenging, so beautiful, and so nice with someone of the same sex. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. You know I'm always honest with you, so I think I should tell you that I live from one encounter to the next. I keep hoping to discover that he's dying to see me, and I'm in raptures when I notice his bashful attempts. I think he'd like to be able to express himself as easily as I do. Little does he know, it's his awkwardness that I find so touching. Tuesday, March 7th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, when I think back to my life in 1942, it all seems so unreal. The Anne Frank who enjoyed that heavenly existence was completely different from the one who has grown wise within these walls. Yes, it was heavenly. 5 admirers on every street corner, 20 or so friends, the favorite of most of my teachers, spoiled rotten by father and mother, bags full of candy and a big allowance. What more could anyone ask for? You're probably wondering how I could have charmed all those people. Peter says it's because I'm attractive. But that isn't it entirely. The teachers were amused and entertained by my clever answers, my witty remarks, my smiling face, and my critical mind. That's all I was. A terrible flirt, coquettish and amusing. I had a few plus points, which kept me in everybody's good graces. I was hard-working, honest, and generous. I would never have refused anyone who wanted to peek at my answers. I was magnanimous with my candy, and I wasn't stuck up. Would all that admiration eventually have made me overconfident? It's a good thing that, at the height of my glory, I was suddenly plunged into reality. It took me more than a year to get used to doing without admiration. How did they see me at school? As the class comedian, the eternal ringleader, Never in a bad mood, never a crybaby. Was it any wonder that everyone wanted to bicycle to school with me or do me little favors? I look back at that Anne Frank as a pleasant, amusing, but super